It's the best, hands down.
It's crystal clear.
I love it. The things you can make are awesome.
No one else has quality epoxy like this.
It's easy to mix.
Tim is such a wealth of knowledge.
It's gotta be iCoat.
Welcome to the Resin Mastery Podcast, exploring iCoat epoxy. So welcome back to Resin Mastery, exploring iCoat epoxy. Today we have a real special episode because I'm down here at Lumberlust Studios with Ryan. Ryan's going to join us and tell us everything about what he does, and it's not flower preservation. Today we're talking about live edge, we're talking about river tables, we're talking about fine woodwork. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for visiting the wood shop.
Oh, absolutely. I just look around, and I think I was telling you earlier, I grew up wanting to be a carpenter, so there's a lot of joy for me seeing all this stuff.
This is a candy store for wood lovers. I mean, all the natural slabs and burl and of course, accented well with creative resin and steel and crystals, and that's kind of my jam here.
Yeah, it's not 2x4s, and I love the fact that, you know, when I turn up, you're rocking out, you've got rock music on, you're doing your thing. It's, you know, it's hot here in Phoenix, but it's just a beautiful thing to see. So a lot of people have actually online got questions for us, so we've got some listener questions as well. But first, you know, what drew you to working with in this format with live edge and with resin?
My first few tables and projects were all live edge, mostly solid wood with just resin functioning for the filler medium and the knots and the cracks and voids and such, and stabilizing the softer woods. But I started doing this as kind of a side hustle about 2014. It became a full-time job for me in about 2016, and stepped away from my photography business that I had been doing for the previous 10 years and decided to make this a full-time go. And I was mostly inspired by the natural shape of the wood as opposed to most of the dimensional planks and hardwood and veneers and stuff that you see that dominate production, you know, store-bought furniture.
Right.
The feel and the look of the solid hardwood and the curvy edges and the flow really inspired me. When resin started first becoming popular, I would say probably around like 2018, you know, deep pour resins were a brand new thing. I think most of us were doing layered pours for various artistic effects, but also to avoid the dreaded exothermic, you know, overheating. And especially being here in Phoenix in the desert, that's a constant struggle, even for the most experienced of us, and trying to make do with the shop spaces we have and keep everything cool and airflow.
So you mentioned exothermic. I hear so much from people, I burnt my flowers, you know, I did this in, and it's reacting strangely. And I don't think they've understood enough about the business, looked into it, did enough homework, and now that exothermic reaction's happening, whether it's burning pieces that they put into their resin, they could be using the wrong resin, so obviously as it reacts, gets to the wrong temperature. And there's a lot to learn to get things absolutely right. So, you know, you do all these beautiful river tables, you do, you know, beautiful live edge. What was your first table like? And if you had the chance again, what would you tell yourself back then if there was anything you would have done differently?
My first tables, like I said, didn't have as much resin. They were more solid wood. But at the time, I didn't fully understand the characteristics of wood movement and how things shift, or how to reinforce or to build things like with table legs and support systems on the underside for longevity, as well as my finishing process has evolved over the years. I've tried every major type of finish. Tried making my own finishes, and so all of that's kind of evolved. I mean, I've experimented with most major resin brands. Some are poured in one full deep pour for translucent smoke resin effect. Others are done in more layered pours for oceanic, where you know, there might be several different resin products used in the process of making the table. It's not just one, you know, deep pour resin. resin. It might be a faster curing casting resin followed by like a tabletop for the ocean waves, and that gets like the lacing effect. Or I've done other subtle metallic pigments that are wisped into clear resin for just subtle movement, and all of those kind of adjust the process of how it's done, which products I use to achieve that, and of course avoiding those pitfalls of like overheating just achieving the overall what do we want it to look like in the end, and what's it going to take to achieve that without having regrettable outcomes.
Right. So you mentioned earlier you've got a photography background, right? And you actually mentioned, and the moment you said it to me, red cameras, I knew, okay, this guy was in deep. He just didn't own a Nikon and was out there taking pics, right? Mm-hmm. So have you applied a similar sort of philosophies into how you've delved deeply into this? And it sounds like you have, with the using different types of resins within a same job to get a different effect. Mm-hmm. That seems to obviously work well when you're dealing with such amazing craft pieces, high end. So when did this start from going to be just a hobby or something you just love doing on the side to something where you thought, I can make a business out of this?
Sure. I did it as a hobby out of my home shop for the first, I would say, about a year and a half. And I was mostly building pieces for our own family and friends and things like that. Like I said, by 2016, I was doing it full time. And it's been a full time job for me since then. And work comes in waves, and sometimes by months, sometimes by years. I'm currently booked out about 60 days for projects with existing custom orders. There's been other times in the history of the business where I was either building my own inventory or show pieces or just shifting my focus to keep busy for a month or two.
So is that what you do if you're quiet? You'll build pieces as custom makes that you love and then just go sell them?
Oftentimes, yeah. I know. I mean, really, what I've realized is a more effective approach is really trying to fish for the next jobs while you're building your current ones, and using the content that you're making, sure, videos, photos of the pieces you're making to attract future orders. That doesn't always work. The algorithm doesn't always play nice, or sometimes the content just doesn't get traction when you think it would. I mean, luckily resin pours usually do well YouTube and Instagram, TikTok, wherever. My resin pours are always still some of my most viewed content. Overall, some of the more fine word working or traditional type pieces, it just, the resin, people love that pour.
It's funny, people like always talk, you don't want to know how the sausage is made, but in this industry, everyone wants to know how the sausage is made. They want to see the pour, they want to see the end result. And you look on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, any of these visual platforms, Pinterest, the visual sells the work because it inspires people, and life's about memories. And these are creating memories for people. Remember that table we had when we were mum bought or dad bought for the guest room, and they're the things that people don't get rid of because they're just so special, they're handmade. So what tools, materials and others are essential for someone starting out? Let's say someone wanted to being so inspired with what you do that they're like, I want to do this. What are the basics that they actually need to get rolling?
That's a tough one. In general, setting up your workspace to function, to build what you need, I think sometimes comes before purchasing the tools. In my scenario, I had a home shop that already had two wall mount ACs. It was insulated, had low enough ceilings that I could keep the shop at 70, 75, right, and do deep pours without a problem with a couple blower fans. It's all about keeping the airflow. A lot of the people that come into the shop and visit here at the sawmill to purchase wood for their own resin projects, most common mistake mistakes are, you know, they're trying to do it in their garage and it's 95 degrees. And it's like, they're, no matter what kind of resin they're using, they're going to have problems.
Yes.
And but on top of that, they've usually gone to Home Depot and bought like a tabletop epoxy and they're trying to pour it at like an inch and a half deep. And of course it cracks in 5 minutes and you're boiling and getting smoke and all kinds of outgassing of nasty plastic. And it's just like, you don't want, that's what, absolutely what everybody wants to avoid is just wasting dollars. And even starting out, I usually try to recommend people start small. You know, purchase a small HDPE mold that you can cut things to size and reuse and experiment with different things without necessarily having to worry about resin form leaking or, you know, dumping resin on your, on the ground of your shop, that kind of thing. I mean, the obvious tool purchases are things like a jigsaw or a sander or a vacuum,
like a belt
air scrubber, belt sanders, you know, air cleaners, like HEPA air scrubbers, I think are critical for, and vacuums for doing resin work to avoid inhalation of dust of the wood and the resin. And
so you use a respirator most of the time when you do a lot of sanding and that sort of thing?
Probably not as much as I should, just because it's uncomfortable to wear in the heat. I actually just ordered a new one, a different brand that's more of like a full face with an eye shield for when I'm doing more grinding and carving and stuff like that. But I, you know, I have an air scrubber here in my shop that, and then I use a HEPA vacuum dust extractor with my sanders and saws, and they're not 100%, but they're a lot better than using nothing, especially in a small home shop.
Right. At what moment did you realize that, okay, making these beautiful things, this is work, and I can do this as a business? Was there a a job, a moment, or something that happened where you're like, I can do this? And how was the conversation with your wife?
Sure. Well, and I mean, honestly, I think getting through 2020 and then succeeding afterwards, considering all the cost in living, cost of materials, everything, you know, everything for everybody's gone up.
Right.
And spending power for a lot of like middle class family is not what it was. And so in some ways, my clientele has shifted to reach the people who can afford it, and because I have to charge more to keep the lights on,
but
so to speak,
profit,
and cover my basic needs for shop overhead, my own personal bills, you know, paying myself as a for doing all the work, and that's something that's really just changed over time. Is as you gain experience and as you gain a reputation, you can charge more for your work than people who are just starting or who are in their home shop or whatever. But it also comes with all the extra overhead, and you have to get to that point where you're putting in your time of, okay, I have this reputation of people are looking for me, they know of my name, they know of my work, or my style is different than every other resin table that's out there, because there's a lot of them, you know.
I actually did a Google search and then actually AI search for the top 10 resin artisans in the United States, and you were in the top 10.
Oh, that's you know, fun.
It's
no,
great that AI already recognizes
cool.
you, right?
Nice.
So yeah.
Didn't know that.
So this is high-end stuff. We're not talking about like a $100 table or something here, right? So how do you price something like this? Because I look at some of this stuff and go, that's priceless.
Yeah, a lot of times it's my markup, or with how I price things, it's based off of, you know, the materials and the time that go into it. Some projects are more heavily investment into materials, like with really specialty large burls or, you know, wood slabs for big dining tables. Some of those are several thousand dollars just for the raw wood before any work goes into it. And then you're putting another several, you know, a couple thousand dollars into steel bases or, and, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks of time into it. And so in a lot of scenarios, I look up, you know, I look at, okay, well, we've spent this much on the wood, this much on the resin. We've got mixing buckets and stir sticks and pigments, and I've got to run the AC for 2 weeks. I've got to move it back and forth, and I'm going to burn through $200 in abrasives, and you know, another $120 for Odie's oil, or you know, and so on, and fasteners. You know, everything is Everything costs money. And
do you have to line item those out, or do you line item those things out for clients?
I don't.
Or you just give a finished price?
I rarely have people ask for an itemized type of thing like right. that. But in some scenarios, I will have them purchase the wood directly from, you know, if they're visiting here and they're buying a slab from the sawmill rather than me just selling that to them as a pass-through cost, I'll have them buy the slab and then just pay me for the labor, because then I can just price it as service only, and it's not sales tax.
Right, that's
it's
smart.
Like, yeah. Whereas otherwise, if it's a full table with a slab and legs and finished out, and you know, it's sales tax on the gross, the whole bottom line, as opposed to just on, you know, just sales tax on materials.
So I have a couple of listener questions. I posted about you online and got people saying, oh, ask him this. I told them that I was doing an interview with you for the podcast, and they're like, oh, I want to ask him this. So any tips and tricks for eliminating bubbles? Because we hear this all the time. Do you have any way to pressurize with such a big job? Or what epoxy do you use? Let's say for this table, I'll take a pic. We'll post this pic online as well. Tell us what you used resin-wise and how you went about eliminating bubbles, because I don't see a bubble in it. Especially without gassing around wood as well.
Yeah.
So talk us through that.
There's several techniques that I use in the process of helping minimize or eliminate the bubbles. I've never had a pressure pot to pressurize and remove the air from it. I've always mixed it in the bucket and you let it set for a couple minutes to let the bubbles rise, and then I'll do the pour. But from my experience, bubbles can occur from pockets or soft spots in the wood. So to help minimize that, you know, doing a seal coat over the wood can help eliminate bubbles from the resin just filling in all those cracks as it cures.
Do you use a particular sealer for that?
I have used Fastset iCoat epoxy, or I've also used the urethane,
the wood seal,
TP21, I believe it's called, and I just brush it on over the live edges. And then usually if I do a resin coat over the surfaces and live edges, I'll go back and just scuff it with a nylon brush to help get the bond better when you do the casting resin back over it. Making sure there's no voids or like negative spaces in the undersides of the slabs. Oftentimes the resin just can't rise. Air gets trapped and you get these bubbles in the voids of the slabs sometimes. And in that case, like, no amount of pre-coating or seal coats or, you know, any of that will avoid, you know, those kinds of bubbles. So in those scenarios, I will often pre-fill the voids in the underside, or tape it or dam it in a way with like silicone so that the resin will fill those areas without creating that air trap bubble.
Is that where you'll use like a different epoxy, like a Fastset epoxy or something?
Yeah, exactly. And it's same thing with like some of the end grain, like the big double walnut burl dining table that I've been working on. It's all the resin's been poured in this shop with just the AC vent blowing, the spot cooler blowing at it. And I use the iCoat tabletop resin and with a gold pigment that matches the brass bases, and basically just squeegeed it into all the cracks in pours. It was done in about 3 pours total, because the tabletop is like 2 1/4 thick. The voids are all pretty small except for the main pits. So it was mostly just about working that resin into all those cracks and stabilizing it.
Right.
So in that case, I use that resin. And with this other one that we've been talking about, the Oceanic, I used the... I can't remember what it. It's a casting resin, but it's the
HV 4100.
The HV 4100.
Yeah.
And you can see it's about 3/4 to 1 inch deep.
Yeah.
And then from after that cured, I used clear and an opaque white for the ocean, the wave layers over the blue. In that layer, while it was gelling, I set the white quartz geode and the clear selenite in there so that they would kind of layer into the it didn't just look like it was sitting on top.
It was
like in the resin. And so, but yeah, it's been, after that was cured, we just polished it up to 4,000 grit. I'm going to oil it and then I'll go at it with polishing compounds, a couple different stages of polishing compounds to get it to full clarity.
Another customer, I mean, a listener question. When a customer has a request, let's say, you know, you've done a beautiful piece and they like, I want to put gold legs on the table. Is that something you think about talking them out of or recommending a different way? Or do you just let them fly with whatever they want?
It depends on their
accessories.
Yeah, it depends on the suggestion. The most common thing that I get that I try to talk them out of is solid black resin, because a lot of people see that on YouTube. And honestly, it's the easiest thing to do, in my opinion, because solid black, like you can hide any flaws.
Right.
In my opinion, it's the least attractive river table because it's filling and hiding the depth of the shape and the live edge of the wood, and you're sacrificing that visibility to like where you can look into the void,
right?
To preserve that, I usually try to talk clients into doing a black base pour and then doing clear up from there, so that you still get the effect of the contrast of the black, but you can still see the live edge and you can still get that visual effect of like looking into the table,
right? So yeah, it's amazing. So, you know, great questions from the listeners. So obviously, this is high-end, luxury customers in the main. How do you go about, you mentioned a little bit about social media, how do you go about finding your customers, or how do they go about finding you?
Most of my customers find me via word of mouth.
Okay.
You know, they shared a dinner at another client's table, or they went to some kind of gala or something, and I had made the clubhouse countertop or the conference table, and so word spreads. It's notoriously hard to reach wealthy clientele that are looking for this in a lot of scenarios, because they're not usually on social media.
Right.
Has been my scenario, especially older folks that typically have the spending power, they're not spending their days on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok if they're on there at all. And in a lot of scenarios, I'll go to send them a video of me working on their piece, and they're like, oh, I'm not on Instagram, or I'm not on YouTube, or I don't use social media. And so it certainly makes hard, because they're not going to then reshare the video.
Right.
It's not going to, but they might have 10 friends that come and have dinner at that piece, and then three of them contact me about ordering something custom for their home.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how can they find you online? Give a website, give social media handles, and let people know.
Yeah, if you search Lumberlust on any major social media platform, or Google, Bing, wherever, you'll find me. I'm on Instagram, YouTube, Pinterest. My website is lumberlust.com. I have a blog on my website that pretty much follows every major project from raw slab to finished table. So if you want to see more steps and videos of the process, that's where you'll find it. Most of the videos of mine on Instagram and YouTube are not DIY videos per se. They're really more to just kind of share the process. I don't necessarily go into detail or create shopping lists of, hey, this is how you're going to recreate what
right.
I'm making, because I'm a little bit sensitive about, you know, I try to make things as original as possible, not for somebody to try to just recreate it.
Correct.
Verbatim.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do try to give and respond to comments with advice or technical tips if people ask. But the nature of my channel is not very DIY oriented. It's more to just kind of show off what I'm working on and to have that to share with my customers that as I'm working on their pieces.
And again, the URL for your own personal website?
You can find me at lumberlust.com.
Beautiful. Okay, last question for you is, I'm amazed, and it's probably, this question probably answers itself, Ryan, but what keeps you inspired to keep making, and is there a piece out there that you're dying to make?
Every year, I feel like projects level up, and some years I've had projects where I'm like, wow, how am I going to make something more impressive than that piece? Because I have favorites. Some of them are not necessarily the biggest ones, but they might be my favorite for you know, some sort of creative reason or something that happened in the story of the process of making it. And or sometimes it's about the client and the space that they're in. You know, I have some of these homes and, you know, I have a couple clients in Sedona where their bedroom set and their headboards overlook all of the Red Rock Buttes.
Yeah,
and wow. It's an going to their home and experiencing their furniture, I mean, it's an experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're in that scenario and that setting with all this beautiful nature and this custom home and the tables to match, you know.
Right.
And so I've also have some really favorite pieces in a lot more modest houses where, you know, it might be just a really, this person saved up for this table and, you know, they're retired and they wanted something to work on, like a desk in their special home office, something that meant something to them.
Yeah.
And that they, you know, they wanted a special furniture to work around or to live around. And I think that's something that all the customers share is that love for tactile art and you know, it's very real in form and in function, and that, you know, it serves a purpose, but it's also something you just like to admire and,
yeah,
and to
sure.
touch and feel and just enjoy in the home more than just something that you go to a store and bought. It was made for you, you know, and or it was like you picked that out, or it was made special with this, you know, tree, and you kind of, you know, you're bringing the essence of that tree and that the shape of the wood and what, you know, the artist reflection of it, you know, back into the home. And I think that they all see that and enjoy
Excellent.
It.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on Resin Mastery.
Thank you for coming by.
It's been a real pleasure.
Great talking to you.
Can't wait to get the feedback and have more people get to know you and get to know the amazing work you do. So until next time, we'll see you again on the Resin Mastery Podcast, Exploring Eye Coat Epoxy. Until next time.